Let's do the compulsory fake salami.
Yeah. Mom, Tom. Like we haven't been with each other all weekend.
But, you know, one thing that was really interesting, that Fraser's Foucault led me to Islam. Yeah, I thought I had to, you know, we had to interrogate this a bit.
Definitely.
So, what's your manhaj?
Shahadat an la ilaha illallah. Do I need to make my my shahada? Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people misunderstand postmodernism and post-structuralism. And they kind of borrowed this from the right, because the right kind of critiques the left. Obviously, everybody knows the excesses and the crimes of the left. But
I always get kind of annoyed with.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always obviously been critical of, you know, elements of the left and the right, but I always say to brothers, don't just wander into debates amongst rival factions of the Fahd.
Exactly.
And pick sides.
Exactly. Because you're going to end up making mistakes, and you're going to end up joining the debate on their terms and not even realize what you're talking about. So you look at the right, people like Jordan Peterson, etc., you know, they criticize the left as neo-Marxism, as, you know, postmodernism, and then those are the evil things, and that's all that's responsible. That's very crude. And, like, you know, with all due respect to Jordan Peterson, he has no idea what he's talking about when it comes to social theory or the intellectual theory, intellectual history of the West. You know, there's some strands of postmodern thought that are actually really useful and actually are part of my conversion story, believe it or not, such as, you know, just the idea of deconstruction, right? Now, the problem that they're responding to is the idea that everything should be deconstructed. And of course, that's where you get into absurdities. That's where you get into relativism. That's where you get into there is no truth. Everything's liquid. Everything's plastic. And obviously, as Muslims, we reject that. Yeah. But the answer is not to go back to, like, before postmodernity, to, like, the Enlightenment values and the classical liberalism and stuff like that, like people like Peterson would have, because those are equally problematic. Yeah. You know, if not even more problematic on some parts.
I tell brothers, like, in your attack of postmodernism, you're actually accidentally championing modernism.
Exactly. And people don't understand what that entails. Like, people don't realize that all reformist movements, true reformist movements within Islam, are modernist movements, in the sense that there's a paradigm and a certain understanding of history, that history is progressive and it gets better, right? And so that enables people to say, well, okay, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, he introduced certain things like reforms, like justice, and now we have to take them further in different ways that conveniently conform to modern liberal values, instead of looking at the past as a paradigmatic anchor, which is like, that's the best generation, right?
So the postmodernism, post-structuralism, whatever we want to call certain elements,
yeah.
Would you say it's correct to say that they deconstruct, and in you know, using those tools or benefiting from those tools, it's beneficial? The problem is, one of the problems is, once they deconstruct something, you know, lots of people, without realizing, they construct something from their own paradigm.
Or they're left with nothing. And that's the purposelessness and the aimlessness of sort of, you know, the cultural aspects. Exactly. So you think about it like this. Modernism is a disease, and postmodernism is a poison that kills the disease, right? But it's poison, and so it's not going to make you healthy, right? So, like, postmodernism is really useful for deconstructing and taking the wind out of the sails and dismantling modernism, right? So it's not useless. It's not useless, but it also isn't constructive. It doesn't leave you with anything. And so if you don't have an Islamic paradigm or an Islamic worldview to be able to construct after that, or to displace it with that, then you're left with nothing.
What if someone says you don't need postmodernism? We can do other things that kill the disease.
Like what? What else has... I mean, it hasn't... Well, okay. I mean, it can, but I mean, like, you have to be able to understand what modernism is and what are its values and how to respond back. I mean, we live in...
The problem is not knowing what modernism and postmodernism is.
Yeah.
So can you explain?
Yeah, sure. So modernism is, in a nutshell, you think of it as the Enlightenment. Like, the Enlightenment embodies modernism in a sense that, you know, and there's subcurrents and, you know, okay, the map is always more simpler than the terrain. There's, you know, countercurrents and subcurrents or whatever. But the main thrust of modernity is that we can come to objective knowledge, dispassionate knowledge about everything. We can construct a universal justice, universal through a universal culture based off of universal reason, you know? And so that was, you know, responsible for obviously the big push to colonialism and sort of like not valuing other people's systems of reason and traditions of reason and things like that. You know, and there's lots of sort of, you know, either aesthetic or epistemological sort of decisions and valuations that were made, right? The written word over the spoken word, you know, oral tradition is seen as something unreliable, right? Religion is seen as something that's superstitious and taboo, right? Versus sort of the cold objective knowledge of the West, right? So that's modernism in a nutshell. And what happened was that basically the postmodern movement is a response to that movement and basically saying, hold up, your supposedly universal values and knowledge and judgments are actually particular. They are not universal. They don't apply to everybody. They're particular to Europe, maybe even particular to white Europe or to male Europe. Of course, that's where we get feminism and stuff like this. And we're not endorsing it, but we're saying that's the idea, is that it's responding to this over universe, or this, let's call it a false universalism, because we believe that Islam is universal and the universalism. But modernism is kind of the false universalism that postmodernism is responding to. And in order to respond to it, postmodernism's move is basically like, there is no universalism. There is nothing that's universal. Truth is just, you know, it's malleable, it's plastic, it's liquid or whatever. And so your judgments and your values are not any more valuable than mine. They're historically determined, right? That's where we get over-historicism, where now everything's a product of history. Everything's a product of your privilege, your positionality, your subjectivity, these sorts of things. So that's really an effective tool to shutting up a modernist, to saying it's like, okay, you think that Western science is like the end all be all. No, actually, no, it's very particular. It's got assumptions, it's got values, it's got an epistemology, it's got a cosmology, it's got an idea of anthropology. What is the human being? So those are postmodern critiques of modernism, but they don't build anything. So that's the thing. So you can use it as a knife, as a bomb to blow up, to destroy, to dismantle, but then you have to have something else.
Yeah.
Oh, I shouldn't have said the second thing. Let's stick to pre-modern weaponry.
Yeah, you can't say. I was gonna say you can't say a little nice juicy soundbox other than such a public place.
Yeah. But yeah, it has to. But it doesn't leave you with anything, and that's where Islam has to. The historical moment that we're in, a lot of people have, you know, been taken by postmodernism in some form, whether it's like the super like pop culture form of it, or the more theoretical forms of it. Islam now, but people have realized the consequences now culturally of only destroying. Yeah. Only destroying leaves you fractured. It leaves you without relationships, without culture, without community, without purpose. It's very alienating. And so that's where people are really feeling those things now. So that's where now historically at this moment, Islam can step in and say, look, you didn't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater. You didn't have to get rid of everything or deconstruct everything. It was important to deconstruct modernity. It was important to deconstruct the project of the Enlightenment. But there is truth. There is objective truth. But it doesn't come from human beings. It doesn't come from universal reason. It comes from Allah. It comes from the divine.
You say that some Muslims that shout about postmodernism, against postmodernism, and at the same time, you know, complain about modernity. They are themselves postmodernists.
Most people just don't understand. Most people don't understand what postmodernism really is. And it's not their fault, because again, there's a difference between what goes on in the academy, the books, like, you know, it's like, you know, there's a huge difference between Foucault and these deconstructionists and reading them in the academy, and then how they're interpreted and then deployed in real time in the real culture, right?
I mean, I mentioned Foucault. I absolutely love reading. I mean, I know he's a giant, you know.
He's a shaitan. Yeah. He's a shaitan. Yeah. But some of his books are awesome.
Yeah. It's awesome to read.
Yeah.
Right. Deconstructing kind of some of the popular notions around modernity and the things that secular states today, you know, claim about themselves.
Yeah.
What was it about Foucault that kind of, you know, led you to Islam?
Maybe. Yeah.
No, I mean, the hadith of Abu Huraira reminds me of Foucault, like, Sadaqa wa huwa kadhub, right? It like, says about the shaitan. It's like, you know, he spoke the truth even if he's a liar, you know? The most, I think, important book of Foucault is The Order of Things, and that's the one that I read in undergrad that really sort of shifted my thinking and got me into the idea of genealogical work, what he calls and what the postmodernists call genealogy. Genealogy is just basically trying to trace back, how do we get here? right? We have certain sensibilities. We have certain thoughts about things. They didn't come from nowhere. They're not self-evidently true. So where do they come from, right? You know, for example, the idea of the nuclear family, right? The idea that of a two-income household, the idea of, you know, all these sorts of things, these sensibilities that we have, you know. So, for example, yeah, we were talking before about how someone kind of challenged me because I'm very critical about feminism and things like that. And they're like, well, I love my career. Like, I'm not miserable. I'm not like the slave of some, like, you know, jerk boss who's hitting on me. Like, I actually love my career. I chose it and I'm very fulfilled. And my point was like, you know, like Foucault would say, how much did you really choose it?
I love my career, but I can't wait till the weekend.
Yeah, no, right, exactly. Well, that's a different critique. But yeah, no, Foucault would push you to think, well, what is choice really? Because you grew up in a society that was not neutral to this decision. It had values, and it values one thing over the other. And it's going to deploy certain power in order to get you to choose one over the other, whether it's cultural sort of influence, shame, exactly, valuation. You know, people telling you since you're a little kid, it's like, oh, you're gonna do great things. You know, what do you wanna be when you grow up? Oh, yeah, it's like, I wanna be a good person that gets an agenda. Nobody says that. They say, it's your employment. Right, so we're valued by our employment. Like, these are very particular things.
How faithfully you serve the production.
Yeah, of course. How much we trash old people. Old people are useless within, you know, our capitalist system because they don't produce.
Somebody looks after old people as a job, gets paid, or, you know,
yes,
profit for some shareholder somewhere. Then they're fulfilling their potential.
Right, they have
if
to monetize
looking
it.
After their own parents. How sad.
Exactly. You know? It has to be read in the economy as a wageable, sort of taxable, and that's taxable.
Income earning sort of scheme, right? It's this commodification of labor, the commodification of the self, putting numbers to it, evaluating it, very materialistic, right? So Foucault gets us to think about, well, what led you to make that choice, and how much can we say that choice was really yours? And obviously that can be taken to a ridiculous extreme. Yeah, it was your choice morally, but let's not pretend that there weren't influences that shaped which one seemed exactly. Yeah. He's a little bit. No, people who took him to an extreme, and he didn't say that. That's not actually what Foucault said, but some people interpreted him or misinterpreted him as Qadri, is like, just like, you know, ijbar. It's like you have, and that's actually where we get identity politics from. Like the idea that, you know, you are determined to only be able to say certain things if you're a white, straight man, white, you know, the cishet, patriarchy, right? Supposedly, what's the critique there? The idea is that your identity and positionality determines, hard stop, what you can say, what you can think. You can't represent justly somebody with darker skin than you, somebody who's not straight, etc., whatever, you know, which is false, quote unquote straight. Yeah, right. Let's say right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah, almost that. But so you know, that's kind of taking Foucault to an extreme that he actually espoused. But Foucault was trying to get us to seriously think about what constitutes us, right? To go in a self-introspective sort of journey of, you know, what are the factors in society and elsewhere that shaped me to have my sensibility in the first place, that I would like a career as opposed to staying at home, you know, etc.
So that kind of spirit of Foucault led you to questions?
Definitely. So I came into undergrad as an atheist, as an anarchist, left, I was a feminist, I took women's studies classes, like all this sort of stuff, you know, and then Foucault and friends, that whole sort of, you know, intellectual tradition got me to do a genealogy of myself. And at the same time, I was studying post-colonial theory, right? So that showed me an international dimension about how the same sort of beliefs and values that the Enlightenment held were wielded in a colonial way upon mostly the Muslim world and elsewhere. And so that's kind of put, I quickly kind of came to see how epistemologically the Islamic world and Islam was the only serious challenge to the episteme of the West. And that just made me really super curious. I was super interested in it, and that started this whole sort of, that was like a deconstruction, reconstruction phase. That was what was happening in my life. I was basically deconstructing myself and sort of, you know, taking a genealogy of the things that I had believed in up until that point. And then at the same time, I was becoming exposed to Islam through various contacts and friends and things like that, and seeing that there was another way possible, and a way that was very, very appealing.
Mm-hmm. So you said Islam was the only challenge to the Western episteme. Can you expand what you mean by episteme?
Sure. Episteme, well, it's just how we know what we know, but it's certain values about sort of that affect your worldview and affect everything else downstream of it, right? So when it comes to, you know, if you want to see the Western epicene like represented in a very crude but honest way, read what's his face, you know, the guy who got, you know, Salman Rushdie. It's not his books, but he has an essay, and he like has this stupid rant that he goes on where he says that like this, you know, West is about eating bacon and short skirts and kissing in public and stuff like that. Like he actually is extreme, like the mask is off completely. And he's like basically talking about when we talk about fighting for freedom, it's like, this is what we're talking about. Like no true Westerner would be so impolite to say those things out loud, but he kind of took the mask off and showed that, you know, this is really kind of what it's about, right? This idea of, let's say bodily autonomy, right? Thinking that I own myself in an absolute way, right? That's part of the Western episteme. Thus, because I own myself absolutely, I get to do whatever I want with myself. So now I have the right to express every desire that comes about inside of me. And in fact, my sort of satisfaction in life depends upon my exercising and realizing and actualizing that desire, forming an identity around those desires. All that stuff comes from the Western episteme. You own your body. Your body is the site of your desires. Your desires are there for you. You have to act on them.
Central and, to your personhood.
Yeah, it is your personhood, really, because they don't believe in a soul, really. Like, not like it. Some, they recognize that some people believe that there's a soul, but that's not the real hard self, right? Like someone said, hard history in our conference, like hard materialism. The real self is just your body, your desires, you know, your consciousness, whatever. And then you might have some beliefs and some cultural traditions, but you know, that's just like extra. So that's the Western episteme, among other things. And so, you know, Islamic episteme is entirely opposed to that. You don't own yourself, at least not absolutely. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you yourself as a gift. And so because it recognizes that gift exchange, there are strings attached, right? You can't do with it whatever you want. There's expectations as to how you're supposed to carry yourself. What are your aspirations in life? Obedience, fidelity, right? Gratitude. These are things that are baked into the relationship of the Islamic episteme as believing that Allah gave you you, right? Totally different orientation towards life. And then everything that's downstream of that, you know, how are we supposed to be in this world? Do we recognize ourselves as created beings and that have been placed here in a position of stewardship, khilafah, right? And so that changes our, instead of viewing, you know, if I'm a material being that needs a certain amount of calories every day and all of, you know, you're my competitor, then I have to get mine. Scarcity mindset, competition, survival of the fittest, stuff like that. There's all these things that it sets off. Whereas if I believe that this is, you know, a gift and I'm a steward, then my relationship to you is one of care, is one of concern, is one of compassion, right? Even if we disagree, let's say, you know, for if there was like a non-Muslim here, it's like I might hate their decisions and hate their ideology and hate their guts, but I still want good for them. I want them to be guided. That's a relationship of stewardship because Allah put me here to care and take care of everybody, you know, exactly. So, you know, the everything's different. Everything's different, you know, and that's what we're talking about.
So the Islam presents the only major challenge to the Western episteme.
Yes.
How do you feel then when you see Muslims attacking certain Western notions from a Western, another Western standpoint?
Yeah, it's maddening because it's basically suicide, you know, intellectual suicide, because we don't realize, and this is the use, here we go again, the use of Foucault and the use of postmodernism is taking those things seriously. How much are you constituted by modernity? How much are you constituted by secularism? How much are you constituted by these ideologies that are actually destroying Islam inside of you, right? You need to be able to
take stock of that.
Do you see it happening on both sides of the US culture wars when Muslims
are? Oh, 100%. So, you know, for the left, my hijab, my choice, that's not an Islamic position. Like, that's the most ridiculous sort of thing.
Wrong.
Yes. That's a great, totally photobombed. Yeah, so my hijab, my choice is an entirely leftist, has nothing to do with Islam. Like because the argument is from autonomy, and we don't even recognize that autonomy within Islam. Like autonomy is not normative in that sort of way, right? Or valued in that sort of way. So my hijab, my choice is a perfect illustration of somebody who's trying to make it. They think that they're making an argument for Islam, but they're making it from
a Western statement. Might be fine, whatever, but it's built on some assumptions that are
from a different world. Yeah, it's built on completely wrong assumptions. It's like,
in some sort of really basic choice, like yeah, you choose to sin or not, you choose to obey Allah or not.
You have
exactly. You have an ontological freedom, but prescriptively, you don't have a freedom. You have to put it on, like you have to wear it. And you know, if it's going to be worth anything, it's got to be sincerity and stuff like that. But those are separate issues, right? But then, yeah, it happens on the right too. So then you have people that, you know, they try to say, you know, there are some Muslims that believe that, again, that the solution is to go back to classical liberalism or to accept, you know, sort of the right sort of version of things. And that's also equally problematic, right? It's like, you know, going back towards ideas of you know, that time before postmodernism, like, isn't going to do us any good, really. We're going to just go back to Enlightenment values that, you know, really sort of had Islam in its crosshairs and contradict Islam in a fundamental way as well.
So would you say both of them are situated in the secularist paradigm?
Oh, 100%. They have to, you know, that's even more foundational than liberalism.
Even if they may present themselves in Islamic garb.
Of course, that's the... because they present themselves in Islamic garb and terminology.
So somebody might say, well, I'm not a secularist. I'm saying... from an Islamic point of view, this is...
They don't understand what secularism is, because secularism is not a separation, or it's not an irreligiosity. It's not a separation of society from religion. It's the production of a new type of religion that is manageable by liberal values and the liberal state, right? So it's precisely, like, you know, if you want to look at other religious communities, look at Vatican II, look at Catholicism after Vatican II, right? It's the council they had in the 60s where they basically said that we're going to abandon all of our traditional teachings and do, you know, update, modernize ourselves, get in line with the times, like, you know, progressive values and social justice and all these meaningless empty signifiers that basically just meant whatever people value at the time, we're going to now relate to our tradition in a way that we're cherry picking and selecting in order to conform to sort of whatever is the taste of the day. So that's secularism in action right there. You say that you're religious, you say that you're Catholic, you say that you're quoting the Bible, you're quoting whatever, but the way that you're interacting with your tradition, your text, is not one of submission. It's not one of ontological or epistemological submission. You're manipulating it and you're putting together a new narrative that nobody's ever used before that is actually in line with modern secular liberal values. That is secularism in a nutshell. So that's happening to us right now, right? And we're the last sort of community that's resisting, and we have the stuff to beat it, but we have to be aware. We have to be self-aware. And like things like My Hijab, My Choice or other things like that, that is the very way in which secularism plays out.
So we're attacking the kind of lefty or liberal, I know the different things, but like a liberal... My Hijab, My Choice thing.
Yeah.
Just for maybe for balance.
Yeah.
Something on the right we want to attack, maybe so people can see, not attack, but highlight maybe certain popular statements or sentiments that maybe people don't realize that they're built on, still built on modernist or secularist foundations.
Yeah.
Maybe like an, I don't
know.
Kind
of think because I'm responding to left all the time these days. And so like, it's like, you know, the nadir is there's a small group of people who are consumed by the right. But
maybe like the rise of kind of certain.
I was gonna say like yeah oh yeah that's a good that's a good thing yeah so like the anti-feminism right so you the, all the sort of you know fake post you know machoism and stuff like that like a lot of that stuff is very crude and I don't even know that the thing why I didn't think of that I think is I wouldn't even necessarily situate that on the right. I don't even see how that necessarily fits in with what is traditionally thought of as conservatism or the right. It is literally just a reaction. But it is a good demonstration to show, at least culturally, within the culture wars, the cultural right, like this sort of, let's go into red pill stuff, right? It's like red pill, for example, is the vast majority of it is found on evolutionary biology, right? Which is very, very anti-Islam, right? So you've got guys that are like, women, they only value like, you know, top G's and like, you know, like high value men. And you've got to like, you got to work on your game and you've got to like show them who's, and like all the sort of like strategizing. What's the ontological or anthropological assumption behind that interaction, right? You're saying it sets it up in sort of an adversarial and a competitive sort of way. So if I'm trying to attract a female. Exactly. It's the same exactly. Yeah. No, that's actually a really good example. Yeah, exactly. So it's basically scarcity resources, competitors. I need to basically either conquer you or trick you in order to or you know, dominate you in some sort of way in order to reproduce with you, which is crazy, you know, and it's not again, that's founded in evolutionary biology. This entire idea that of sort of what the human being is and what human life is that completely negates the possibility of an afterlife, of God, of, you know, morality, these sorts of things. Whereas the Prophet said it, it's half your deen. Getting married is half your deen, right? And that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran said that we made you into pairs so that you would find peace with one another. What, where's the peace in sort of, you know, I have to constantly outsmart and I have to thwart my wife and like this, you know, constantly sort of like work against them this way. That's not an Islamic paradigm. Yeah, or competing with other men and things like that. It's not an Islamic paradigm, right? So we end up, this is what the thing, if you're not grounded, you're going to end up just swinging to the other extreme. Yeah. You know, you're going to be just as un-Islamic in the other direction, right? We really need to construct and reconstruct and remind people of what is the Islamic worldview, what is Islamic epistemology, what is the Islamic idea of what a human being is, you know, of what sex is, of what, you know, all these things, so that they don't get blown away in the culture wars.
How do we do that? What are your plans? So your what's your role in
Yeah, that's basically my mission statement, my mandate, like for joining Yaqeen is to do this work, right? I deconstruct and I reconstruct. So I'm supposed to deconstruct everything that is anti-Islamic in the cultural wars and stuff like that, modern ideologies, and I'm supposed to reconstruct and present and convince the Islamic worldview and how it's different and distinguish it. And so the first step we took in that is a podcast called Dogma Disrupted. So it's, you know, long form hour to 2 hour conversation with folks hitting on these specific issues, exploring them. But then from those conversations, we're going to make a shorter video series, like maybe like 3 to 8 minute videos, called Think Again, where it's going to focus in on these sort of discursive, interventions, right? These, you know, slogans, even like My Hijab, My Choice and things like that. To try to deconstruct what are the philosophical ideas under this, why do they contradict Islam, and what does Islam say instead? And then after that gets going, the plan is to even reduce that further down into smaller content, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, right? To be able to really try to go for reach and try to even construct new terminology, right? We need new terminology in order to fight this battle, because part of the terms that we use affect the way that we think about things. Talking about Islam as a religion doesn't indicate whether it's true or not, right? Talking about it as the haq, right? Like, is an entirely different thing, you know? Talking about...
So, you know, we have this running list of untranslatables.
Yeah.
Islam trending C.
Yeah.
So we don't translate, for example, iman.
Yes.
Deen.
Right.
We try not to, though. We don't use, like, faith and religion. And
no, they're not the same thing.
So, yeah, we're probably going to try and build, once you build enough of these things, probably have some kind of page somewhere that you can take your time and express those things. But
yeah,
until then, you know, we have to try and use our own terminology. Terminology is very important.
It is. I mean, look at the difference between calling someone a sodomite, right, versus calling someone a homosexual. Like, that is a classic example of how the shift has happened to against our favor. Right, it's put us in a position where we're on a losing playing field, right? And so if we're going to win, we have to come up with a new vocabulary. You know, I'm not sure that we can return to the old vocabulary. Maybe we can, maybe we can't, I don't know, but we can come up with new terms that are going to be able to do that work for us.
So so you're talking about, as you said, as an example, sodomy, homosexual, like, okay, yeah, is a very nice statement where you said, you know, the tracking the creation of sexuality,
yeah,
and the invention of sexuality in England, when it went from a temporal aberration to a species, and the sodomite became the homosexual. Mm-hmm. I always try to warn Muslims, don't try to critique LGBT ideology and lobby and so forth from within their own paradigm, because you're fighting one hand behind the back. This paradigm, this discourse only allows two characters.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, the enlightened ally. Number two, the bigoted homophobe. So what do you say to, I mean, there's rows happening in schools in the US right now. Pride Month, for example, you know, doesn't want to, you know, sign a card or wear rainbow face paint or whatever at work. How would you say they, you know, at the moment, they're taught almost, they're given an allowed set of terminologies,
yes,
that they're or an episteme that, yes, they're allowed to express a disagreement, yep, within, yep, but it's not an Islamic one,
yes.
So how would you, so they end up becoming maybe copying right than Christian or whatever, kind of attacks. What would you say to Muslim parents, or from your perspective in the US, what do you say when somebody's coming asking you about why can't Muslims take part in this XYZ at work or in school?
Yeah, it's an extremely important question, and that's part of the idea behind the whole Navigating Differences document, that we tried to give people a thing that they could just take and hand to somebody, that they didn't have to make that argument themselves, because it is tricky business. Actually, I was having conversations with groups both in the US and in Canada for what's the most effective discourse to use when trying to carve out the space. And there's a lot of disagreement, and each one has pros and cons. Nothing's perfect. Some people are trying to focus on parental rights, and that has pros and cons, right? Because that obviously indicates, well, okay, well, what if we have Muslim parents that are okay with it? And that's another problem, right? There's other people that are playing the minority game. It's like, you're a minority, we're a minority. I think obviously that's demonstrated that loses. That's a losing strategy. I don't think that's a way forward. Other people have said, well, let's go to Islamophobia. That's what they did in Canada. They're trying to report these incidents that are happening as Islamophobic incidents. I'm also not satisfied with that. I think that that has other problems. It's basically further fortifying the homophobia discourse, you know, by saying that somebody disagrees with, you know, Islam, that they're homophobic or something like that, is like something, someone disagrees with, you know, with sodomy, that they're homophobic. I also don't like, you know, re-entrenching that discourse. One of the things that I'm interested in exploring the possibility of, and I don't know, I haven't fully thought through how effective it would be, but Native Americans have rallied around this idea of epistemic sovereignty and sacred teachings. And I think that might have a lot of potential for us, because it shifts the terrain from an identity game into about like who I am, which the response for non-Muslims is, well, there's this other Muslim that's fine with it, or there's this other Muslim who's gay, right? That's the next move for them, to reinserting the teachings in there and anchoring us in the teachings. And that way, if we're able to sort of bridge that gap and say, there is no separating us from our teachings. And if you try to separate us from our teachings, you're actually doing some sort of violence upon us. You're harming us, you know, you're whatever, you're bigoted. That, to me, that's the most promising sort of discourse that I've seen so far when it comes to, you know, managing all the different sort of avenues by which we're getting slaughtered by this thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you manage to insert some of these things into the statement?
No, I was not involved in the crafting of the wording of the statement myself. So I was only a signatory. But when it comes to one thing that I'm a little bit more involved in is the stuff going on in Montgomery County, Maryland. So there's like a WhatsApp group with 400 messages a day where we're constantly sort of brainstorming about how this is going to happen, what discourse we're going to use, what media outlets, who to work with and who not to work with, like what are the parameters of a coalition. There's other people that are trying to undermine and sabotage us, right? This is the Coalition of Virtue, by the way. So I'm a little bit more involved.
What's
in
that about?
The Coalition of Virtue is basically the group on the ground in Montgomery County, Maryland, that is pushing back against the imposition of the school board with their LGBTQ curriculum. The premise of it is that it is a faith-based coalition of values. Right, so they're trying to be broad enough to incorporate believing Christians and Jews and other people who are not pleased with this. Now, there's been sort of an incrementalist approach so far. Like the first step has kind of been to say, well, you took away parental choice to opt out. Now, technically speaking, that's not meaningful because they've put it in every subject, so there's nothing to opt out of. But to take away parental choice and opt out is also bad. So the strategy now for you know that most people have agreed to is to try to reinstate the ability to opt out and then work on corralling all LGBTQ education into one subject. Therefore, opt out is meaningful, right? And the fear is that if you switch that process and do it in the reverse, then that won't work. They won't accept it. So you know, Allah knows best. There are lawyers involved, and they sued the school board and stuff like that. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know the legality of it. I'm more interested in the discourse and the ideology.
I won't get you to, you know, do anything that could be in contempt of court by talking
about yeah.
Revealing any...
Plead the fifth. plead the fifth.
Revealing any, you know, secret game plan.
Yeah.
Whoever might be watching.
Yeah.
But, Yeah, it's always very interesting looking at how different Muslim groups and organizations kind of try to formulate a response from their own paradigm. Really, we did something similar. You remember the maybe London News of Birmingham kind of protest?
Yeah, very much.
That was in the news around as well. But the way it was framed was, here are some bigoted parents protesting against something as neutral as education,
right?
Learning, right? It's simple. Yeah. Facts. The idea was that we were trying to push was these aren't just neutral facts. What you're teaching, what you're imposing is what they're against is proselytizing.
Yes.
Certain beliefs and values and cultural norms of one people over another people, children, no less.
Yeah.
So and that so this is the, I think this is something we need to explore more and popularize, because half of the majority of the battle is to get the white Western male or whatever you mentioned, get him to realize his own assumptions.
Yeah,
that they're not universal truths about life. They are something that he completely accidentally inherited because he was born in a particular place. It's something he inherited from his forefathers, right? And it's not something that he can impose on us. So speaking of, I don't, time's running away with us. I just wanted to get your views about, something similar to what you've been talking about here, but in regards to feminism and your, exposure to feminist discourse.
So there's a huge, people don't understand that there's a huge difference between feminism in the academy and feminism on the ground. And if people understood feminism in the academy, they'd realize how dangerous it is. But the problem is that discursively, what feminism has done, it's very clever, just like other movements have been very clever, is that they've managed to claim responsibility for every good thing done for women anywhere. So it's actually very difficult to detect what's wrong with feminism if you're looking at the goods that it promises to obtain, right? It even goes so morally amorphous to say it's like, well, we can be international feminists and intersectional feminists and support women's upliftment, whatever that might mean in the Muslim world versus the Western world versus whatever. So if you're looking at it from that angle, it's tricky, and at first it doesn't look problematic, but we'll get back to that. But where it is much more obviously problematic is if you look at what is feminism trying to respond to, what is the other of feminism, which is patriarchy. Okay, so patriarchy is understood as, and this is on the books and it's in the popular culture, as something that is a universal and transhistorical category, right? So by universal, we mean across all places, and by transhistorical, we mean all times, right? So that women's oppression is structural, meaning it's not just like they say that racism is systemic as opposed to an individual prejudice. They're saying that patriarchy is the structural oppression of women by men all throughout history, all across places, everywhere. So women being oppressed is because of the patriarchy. It's not because of the individual moral, status of individuals.
Because of, cultural system happens to be.
No. It's structurally about men being in power and making decisions about women. Like, that is the patriarchy, and that is what is responsible for women's oppression. So that is obviously and flagrantly un-Islamic, right? If you look at the society that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was sent to, right? And obviously he was sent to everybody, but he was initially sent to, his immediate community. There was oppression against women, widespread oppression against women. We all know. What was the source and cause of that oppression for women? Was it patriarchy? If it was patriarchy, why wasn't patriarchy corrected? Why didn't Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala send down the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam with something to fight the patriarchy?
Kind of an anachronism, isn't it?
It's extreme in anachronism, yeah. Which is why we have to particularize.
You're holding history, the history of every people, ransom to the, the analysis of or the ideas of, to the ideas of that, why he came along and discovered.
Yeah. No, exactly. Which they'll they'll pretend that it's not that. And that's where you get intersectional feminism and third world feminism and whatever. But that's what it is at the end of the day, right? No matter whatever window dressing they put on it. But that's not the least of its problems, right? The big thing is, what is responsible for the oppression of women? That's what you have to answer. And is it structural? Is it always structural? is there no moral element to it? Because the stakes are huge.
Is it an either or?
Say again?
Structural or moral?
Is what? Sorry?
Can it be structural and moral?
Yes, well, that's the point. So the idea of the patriarchy is that it's primarily, if not entirely, structural, which means that a man cannot be just, cannot represent women if he is in power. He needs to let go of his power in order for women to have power, then justice will be done. That's the claim of feminism. And so if you look at the oppression that women suffered in Arabia in the 7th century, right, women came to the Prophet ﷺ to complain about oppression that was happening even after Islam started to be spread, right? What did the Prophet ﷺ do? It's not a feminist point. People, you know, don't understand these things, what they mean. They'll say, oh, well, they were able to complain directly to the Prophet ﷺ and this is feminism. This is not feminism. Feminism would say that the Prophet ﷺ had to vacate power and let a woman take over. Or, at the very least, feminism would say that the Prophet ﷺ would have to appoint women to positions of power so that they would be represented, so that then they could have justice done by them. Feminism precludes the possibility that men can justly represent and rule over women.
Is that all feminism?
Yes, it is. There's other differences if you get into sex positive versus, you know, like you know, the folks who are against sex positivism or even abortion or other stuff. There's various different strains and controversies within feminism, but this is a lowest common denominator of feminism, the patriarchy and the conception of the patriarchy, right? The patriarchy is a universal, trans-historical,
and even like ubiquitous, we could even say.
Can someone be a feminist and still and think of the patriarchy as not necessarily that?
No,
I don't think so. I think that is that's why I want to draw the attention away from the goods that feminism supposedly promises, because that's murkier terrain, and focus on what feminism claims to be correcting, which is the patriarchy. The idea of the patriarchy is un-Islamic, right? Men can rule over women justly. It is a function of morality. It is a function of the tazkiyat an-nafs, of purifying the soul, of relating to your Lord, and of being just, right? Which is why, you know, traditionally men have been rulers. Men have been rulers or leaders of the household. They've been political leaders. They've been societal leaders. That is all based on the premise that men can rule justly over
nation. The notion of leaders, yes. What a leader means is a heavily drawn from the Western episteme, because, you know, well, we were discussing this the other day with Sheikh Haytham as well, and like a seminar we're doing to just about some kind of skills for leadership. And he said, be careful of the word leadership, because it's from a very distinct, happens to be a corporate kind of very business.
That's true.
Related background in terms of, you know, and he was thinking, we need to think of a way in which we can express this, still learn some lessons about leadership qualities, but not fall into this this mold, right, of a leader is X or Y. Because, yeah, this type of leader or you know, like a ruler, for example, of a tribe or a country or whatever, yeah, a woman shouldn't aspire to be that.
Yes.
From the standpoint of
power. Right.
But does that mean she's not supposed to be, have some kind of leadership qualities, a leading individual, right?
Kulukum ra'in.
Exactly.
So
you're thinking it's not about it's not about the position.
Yes.
It should be about other values like taking responsibility, being accountable,
yes,
you know, getting things done, stewardship, right? So even that is just kind of popped into my head that, everything is just problem with this language and where we're living.
Yeah, no, the terms, in. The terms set, yeah, set us up. Yeah,
it's kind of swimming against the tide.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I mean, that's a good point. That's a good point. But the idea still stands about, you know, about patriarchy is the problem. Now, there are issues with what feminism claims to be good as well, but they're not as readily apparent. Because when it comes to the, you know, basically feminism ran into the problem very quickly that it doesn't have a coherent sense of what is good, right? Because you can't find a universal good outside of religion, right? So outside of faith. It's not anchored or tethered. And so that's why, you know, is it the feminist position to take the veil off in Iran and put it on in France? Right, that's sort of the, you know, the consequence of this, you know, not having a coherent, constructive idea of what is good, right? What is the good that feminism is supposedly achieving for women, right? Women differ themselves; they disagree. Like, there are women who are pro-abortion, women that are against abortion, right, in the United States, and there are women that are.
So wouldn't they just say choice then.
There we go. Well, that's how they solve that tension. They solve that tension from going away from a substantive good and going to a procedural good. So saying, okay, we can't stay coherent and say that this is what's good and this is what's right, you know, when it comes to the results and the concrete substance. So let's go to procedure. As long as women choose it, then it's good. Well, that's also problematic, like, because again, we get back to what is choice, and Foucault would be laughing here because he'd be saying, it's like, well, how do you account for internalized patriarchy, according to them, yeah. Right? We don't agree with the idea of patriarchy as they understand it, but Foucault would say internalized patriarchy. You have women choosing it. Women choose to stay in abusive relationships. Women choose to do horrible things. There's no way to actually morally critique or evaluate these decisions.
It doesn't make it good.
If you accept that, then yes. you have to deal with the problem of infantilizing, you know, someone else.
Exactly.
Say that, you know, I know what's better for you than you.
Yeah, exactly. Agency versus infantilizing versus all these sorts of things. It gets muddy. It gets you know, it's very thin and it's very incoherent. Okay, so it's not that, you know, feminism. So feminism is un-Islamic on both ends, whether the bad that it's supposed to be fighting against, which is the patriarchy, which is an un-Islamic concept, and also the good that it purports to be able to do. But again, what makes it slippery and appealing is that it claims responsibility for every good ever done for women, right? And so this is where you're saying historical anachronism. They'll look into the past and say, Khadija was a feminist, and Aisha was a feminist. And, you know, everybody who, you know, there were women who were anti-suffragists. You know, that's a fascinating thing to look into. There were women that were against women getting the ability to vote. Won't call it the freedom, because that's, again, language, right? And it's really interesting to look into the reasoning why. Like, that stuff is dead and, you know, buried. But they're basically like, we want to protect the household sphere. We don't want it to become a political sphere. We want our sort of separation to be maintained. They almost view the separation as a protection in some sort of way, which has merit to it.
And the whole notion of, you know, seeing empowerment as effectively imitating a man in everything.
Well, that's another
rather
problem.
Rather than expecting the man maybe to imitate.
Yes. No, that's another problem, is that, you know, basically if there is any substantive good that feminism has called for, it's basically defined success as what success is purported to be for men.
But surely if it's something so murky and watered down and so, you know, amorphous, could there be a strategy of just saying, okay, take it to its conclusion, therefore feminism is so undefined and meaningless as a term, so it ceases to have any value for anyone?
Sure. And there are those who have done that, like people who debate, like, you know, the feminists and stuff like that. They often use that as a critique, and it is a valid critique. Why feminism? We can get women's rights. We can, you know, that's why I think, you know, there's a book out there, Women's Rights Without Feminism, or something like that. Like, feminism becomes useless. If you're telling me that it can't really, doesn't really have any idea of what good is, right, then why do I need it? Why can't I get it with this?
If you define it as something so that can be defined from so many different angles.
Yes.
I mean, you could perceive of someone being absolutely horrible to women and saying I'm a feminist.
Yeah, no, it would be justifiable, yeah. Honestly.
Yeah. So anyway,
and if we identify as women, then that's a whole.
Maybe that's a topic for another conversation. But yeah, I look forward to reading some of your articles, inshallah. You promised to, you know, send me some stuff.
Definitely. Yeah, and we have something for Yaqeen Institute coming out within the next month, inshallah, on perennialism, which is going to be the first first article for them.
You're going to be doing the academic style papers on Yaqeen.
Yes.
And send some of the light stuff. For Islam truancy to direct people towards Yaqeen for the academic stuff, inshallah.
But Bismillah, there's a lot of work to do.
Don't forget Islam truancy.
Of course not, Habibi.
So we'll be seeing more of you, inshallah.
Inshallah, I hope so.
I'll let you get.
I should go to catch my flight.
Catch your man flight from the inshallah. So yeah, JazakAllah khairan.
Habibi wa yakum, Habibi.
Mamton. How do you pronounce this name?
Fakini.
Fakini.
Yeah. All the Italians in the UK, salam alaikum. I know you're out there, Italian converts.
Yeah. Forget about it.